ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
At 13, Joan of Arc claimed divine visions. At 16, she was a warrior. By 19, she was burned at the stake as a witch. Hi, I'm James Carlton. Welcome to God Forbid on ABC Radio National and across the Pacific on Radio Australia. It's the panel show about the things we believe. And what we believe about Joan of Arc is always changing. Of course, as a soldier who defeated the English, Joan of Arc is forever loved in France. But for Protestants, she's a victim of Catholic institutional corruption. For Catholics, she's a saintly example of mystic purity. Feminists are inspired by her gender transgressions. Communists loved that she was a peasant who made revolution. Even the Nazis used her as an example of Aryan resistance to decadent internationalism. As for Hollywood, well, it's made more than a dozen Joan of Arc movies. Even a Baz Luhrmann one is on the way. All of which makes Joan of Arc a fascinating episode in our special God Forbid series on religious rebels, those who defied empire, reshaped tradition, and changed the world. And to discuss this extraordinary 15th century teenage girl, the patron saint of France, we welcome Dr. Charlotte Miller from the University of Melbourne, Stephanie Downes from La Trobe University, and in our Perth studio, Dr. Sean Blanchard, a theologian and historian from the University of Notre Dame, Australia. Welcome to you all. Sean Blanchard, you first. Take us back to the time of Joan of Arc and Europe. The English and French kingdoms, there was the Holy Roman Empire, and they weren't really nations like we think of them today, were they?
No, not quite. I mean, I would say France and England are much closer to what we would see developing into a modern nation state. But yes, it's very much about kind of dynastic right. So you have in birth of Joan of Arc in 1412. It's traditionally given that she's born on January the 6th, which is the Feast of the Epiphany. There's a sort of power struggle going on where you have an English crown. You have a king of England, Henry the Fifth, who we know from, you know, Kenneth Branagh, Shakespeare, and more recently, Timothy Chalamet, you know, the great victor at Agincourt. And he has a kind of dynastic claim, in his view, on really the whole of France. But you also have this sort of Burgundian power, which is a kind of composite patchwork of territories that owe fealty to the Duke of Burgundy. So this ends up creating a kind of perfect storm of sort of political and military instability in the world that Joan is born into.
It's almost like a World War One of the 15th century, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I guess there were some very positive things about the world that she's born into. It's this incredibly interesting and culturally rich place and feasts and wine and music, but it's also deeply unstable. It's kind of economically exhausted. I mean, she is born in kind of the same part of the world that was also decimated by the First World War. So that's, I think, a particularly apt comparison. But the world she's born into is constant war, threats of raiding, pillaging. And then religiously speaking, there's also a measure of instability that we sometimes forget about, that when she's born, there are still three men claiming to be Pope. So there's this sort of deep anxiety that the kind of the unity of medieval Catholicism is, there's kind of cracks in the windshield that are gathering, and there are groups around Europe that are popping up who are challenging the sort of hegemonic social and religious power of the Catholic Church. So she's born into a world that's sort of steeped in tradition and steeped in custom, but is also kind of really on the cusp of transitioning into something new, which we see in the Renaissance, the Protestant Reformation, and early modernity.
This is the Western Schism, one of the most damaging crises the Catholic Church ever faced in its history. Two competing popes, a third one proposed to resolve the differences, ends up making it a three-way race.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
To Charlotte Miller, tell me about these feudal webs of conflicting loyalties, dynastic, spiritual, military, all of this amid what we now know as the 100 Years' War. between England and France.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Hundred Years' War, it goes from 1337 to 1453, so actually more than 100 years. Very complicated. There's three main stages. But really, we have this problem where we have the English and the French both claiming that they are the rightful rulers of France. This is very underway when Joan is born, and it's this conflict that she feels that she is divinely sent to engage with and try and help France win.
And the fascinating thing is just next door, we have the Holy Roman Empire, what's left of it, sort of today's Germany, splintering into literally hundreds of semi-independent territories. Sean mentioned the conflicting loyalties, paying homage to the French king, but allying with the English king. To Stephanie Downes, into this we also get a time of great social change, technological change, gunpowder, printing. People are moving to the city. People are learning how to use metal in much more advanced ways.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. We've also got the French Civil War that's really ramping up around the time of Joan's birth in 1412. France has been ruled by the so-called Mad King, Charles VI. His psychotic episodes were so severe that his wife Isabeau frequently served as regent. And because Charles was quite young when he came to the throne, his uncles held a considerable amount of political power. So these were the Dukes of Burgundy, Anjou, and Bourbon. Charles's younger brother, the Duke of Orleans, he's also aspiring to the regency, and there's an increasing enmity that grows between Orleans and his cousin Burgundy. And so France itself has effectively been split into two factions, the Burgundians and the Armagnacs. The Armagnacs side with the French crown, and the Burgundians move into an alliance with the English.
You mentioned the Mad King. He was considered mad at the time. Tell me about Joan of Arc and her visions as a young girl, the age of 13. Was that mad?
It is a question for the ages, James. Many people have argued that she was, that her voices might have been a form of schizophrenia, might have been a form of psychosis. Joan doesn't present them that way, and the people in Joan's world certainly don't see them that way either. The thing they do sometimes think might suggest she was mad is the way she dresses and the fact that she cuts her hair short like a boy, like a man. That was taken to Joan's contemporaries more as a sign of her potential mental instability than the voices that she claimed to hear. For Joan's contemporaries, the real question was, where did those voices come from? There was no question about the existence of the voices. The question was, did the voices come from God or did they come from the devil?
Interesting. Sean Blanchard, why, though, was it relevant that a short-haired 13-year-old girl heard voices? I would have thought that it wouldn't matter where they came from because she was a girl. It's the voices men hear, especially royal men, that count.
Probably the primary avenue that a lot of medieval women had to have a kind of religious voice is through mysticism. You know, it's an intensely patriarchal society, but there is some precedent for the female mystic, women being sort of particularly sensitive to the spiritual. The problem comes, I think, when her visions are seen to kind of impact the real world of politics. I think if she were to go around saying, you know, I hear these voices and, you know, Mary tells me to be obedient to my father and Jesus tells me to be close to him in the Eucharist. I mean, I don't think that sort of thing really would raise too many questions, but when her voices are about, you know, liberating France from the English, when she's asking to be put before the king, I mean, that's eyebrow raising, I think, in a very different way. So I was sort of thinking about the sense of her as a kind of double rebel. It's not just gender, it's also social class. So she's this peasant girl who's claiming that her counsel should be listened to by military leaders and political leaders all the way up to the king. And then she's also this young woman dressing as a male, eventually dressing as a male, sort of the ultimate performance of masculinity. You know, she's wearing plate armor. She's threatening the enemies of her country, saying she'll drive them out, kill anyone who resists. So it's not like she, you know, took on a blacksmith apprenticeship or something. She's sort of assuming a kind of paragon of manliness and even kind of aggression and power. And I think that's why she was so troubling to so many people.
Charlotte Miller, Tell me more about Joan of Arc and her transition from simple peasant girl, not completely impoverished. Her parents had some land, but from female peasant to someone who counsels the elites.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the visionary thing is really crucial here. Part of a history of female mysticism, as Sean mentioned. So we have a number of women, such as Marjorie Kemp, Julian of Norwich, various women who for hundreds of years have been seen to have visions. So these are women who, generally quite young women, who believe that Christ or God spoke directly to them. And in all of those cases, in the same way as happened in Joan of Arc, there is a question about where those visions are coming from. Are they divinely inspired or are they demonic?
Were they the only options?
Generally, yes. You can have the idea that women are being silly and overly imaginative, that their humours are perhaps imbalanced. So yes, there can be a medical explanation, but generally with these sort of mystics who believe that they are getting directly the word of God, it's then interrogated to see, is this God or is it the devil? And it's very difficult for anyone to make that judgment. So Joan was very careful to say, for instance, that when she saw her visions, they came from the right side of her body. The light came from the right. And that's because the left is sinister. And more tied to demonism. But the thing that's important in thinking about Joan of Arc as part of this long line of female mystics and visionaries is that that gives her authority that, as you've said, she wouldn't otherwise have had. So she's a young female of a lower class, but if she has the word of God, then she is someone who can be listened to.
Well, to Stephanie, do you think she became like a woman of God who then, because of what she believed God was telling her, had no choice but to turn to politics? Or do you think she was a politician who was using the religion of the time?
That's a really interesting question. She was in the thick of it. If we think geographically about where Joan is born, she's born in Domremy, in a village that's in the Duchy of Bar, but it's on the border of the Duchy of Lorraine. So she's right on the border on which skirmishes between these two warring factions, the Burgundians and the Armagnacs, often take place. The war with the English has been underway for 75 years already at this point. There's civil war with France. So war and conflict it's already a part of her daily life. The impact that might have had on her convictions isn't really clear, but certainly we know that about her. We know that war was around her all the time. Mm. The voices don't, when they appear, they don't just say straight away, you know, get on a horse and go to the king. They start out, the first voice she hears is the angel Michael, and he tells her to be a good Christian, to live a good life, to deepen her faith. And it's only gradually that the voices she hears start to include the Saints Margaret and Catherine. They eventually compel her that this is what she has to do, that she has to approach Charles, liberate the city of Orléans, and have Charles crowned as a king of France in Reims.
Sean, tell me about this collision between religion and politics. Saints speak to you mystically and tell you what you need to do politically. Is that how events played out in Europe of the time?
Yeah, like the way that we would separate religion and politics is a kind of post-Enlightenment construction, because we're trying to live in a sort of pluralistic society. So we're saying, okay, one could have the political beliefs of a good Australian, you know, respecting freedom of speech or freedom of religion, and I might privately disagree with them about religious matters. This is kind of how we think about these things now. But at that time, to be French, I would say particularly with France, even more so than England or many of the German states or even Spain, to be French was that there's this new Christian nation emerges with the baptism of Clovis, the Frankish king. And Clovis is baptized in Reims, if I can, it's always difficult to pronounce it the way that the French do, but Reims, we could say, in the Reims Cathedral. So this is sort of the Westminster Abbey of the French nation. So the French king in particular was seen by the French people as having really an anointed role. It was a sacral kingship, if you will. They go all the way back to Clovis. It runs through Charlemagne, but also St. Louis IX, so the sort of crusader king who was this kind of paragon of the perfect Catholic and also the perfect, you know, father of his country. So the French took very, very seriously that the king had a kind of religious role as well as a political role, maybe closer to what you see in what we now call the Byzantine Empire. I don't really think the French saw the king as subservient to the Pope. I mean, they believed that the Pope was the head of the church, but they really believed that the French church has a kind of patrimony of its own, and it looks to Rome to resolve certain purely doctrinal disputes. But really, they see the French church as, it's called the eldest daughter of Christendom. So the religious role is even more important for the French people when they look to the crown than to other people in Europe at this time.
On Radio National, this is God Forbid. It's part of our special series on religious rebels. And this week's religious rebel is Joan of Arc, the teenage girl from France who changed the course of Europe. We're with Sean Blanchard, lecturer in theology at the University of Notre Dame, Australia. In Perth and in Melbourne, we have Stephanie Downes, lecturer at La Trobe University, and Charlotte Miller, lecturer in early modern history at the University of Melbourne. Well, Charlotte Miller, to get us into the headspace of the time, 15th century Europe, you have climate change analogy?
Yeah, I can't take credit. It's from a colleague of mine at the University of Melbourne, which she uses to explain religion to first-year students, because I think we have an idea that people in the medieval world are deeply, deeply religious and sort of thinking about religion all the time. And obviously, it's a religious world. There's no such thing as atheism in the 15th century. This is a world where people are Catholic, and that plays a different role in different people's lives. So the climate change analogy is, let's say that we all believe that climate change is real. People will react differently to knowing that. So some people will try and remember to bring their green bags to the supermarket, but sometimes forget and feel a bit guilty about it. Others will go off and live in a commune and try and make their own yogurt and their own dishwashing liquid and try and do everything off-grid because that's the sort of devotion they have to trying to slow down climate change. And I think this works with religion, that we have a world where everyone accepts that God made the world and God is there and he can and does act in the world. But the way in which this actually impacts people's lives and what they do about it varies from person to person. So for most medieval peasants, the church is a key part of their life. It's a place for community coming together. There's a lot of little things in their life that would remind them of religion all the time, such as saints' days or crossing oneself or prayers. But some people are going to be doing this in a very devout, focused way, and other people are going to be doing it as sort of just a habit of everyday life.
Hmm. And Stephanie, I actually, when reading about Joan of Arc and trying to get myself in their head, I was thinking of the Northern Ireland conflict, because it's so many different things to different people. People say, is it a religious conflict, Protestant versus Catholic? They go, well, yes, but it's not just that, and it's not that to everyone. They go, well, is it a political conflict? Is Northern Ireland a part of the Republic of Ireland or part of United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland? You go, well, that's very much a part of it, but that's not all there is. Well, is it about discrimination, about getting poor housing and not getting good jobs? Yes, it's about that, you know, and it's not about that. It's about everything all at the same time, if that makes any sense.
Look, in a curious way, it does, James. I think the short answer is that it's complicated. It's complicated religiously, politically, socially, and all of these things are entangled.
So she must have been a brilliant woman or a cork sort of bouncing on the winds of fate on the ocean sort of thing.
Aha. Well, I mean, this is the question, right? How did she do it? You know, there's the why did she do it? And a lot of kind of ink has been spilled in kind of answering that question. But there's also the how. And, you know, I mean, I think all of these different kind of groups that over the centuries have been attracted to Joan, have been attracted to Joan's story from the religious to the atheist, from the far right to the far left, they're all offering different answers about that how. I mean, that God sent her is one answer, right? It's a kind of answer to how she did it, that it was divine intervention that put her there and allowed her to achieve. But from the point of view of an atheist, if you take that divine intervention away, there's a whole different set of questions about how she did it.
If I could just go back quickly to when we were talking about whether Joan was motivated by her religion to influence politics or she was actually politically motivated and took a religious approach. I think it's just important to think that this girl has grown up in a world where it is strongly believed by everyone that God can speak to you. And so it makes sense that if you have visions and you hear voices, that one of the options is that God is speaking to you. And so I don't think it's a stretch to think she really did believe and had the conviction that God was speaking to her and then acted on that. I think it's more of a stretch for us now, but at the time it was a perfectly reasonable thing to happen.
I wonder what you all think of this, but it seems to me that one of her, like the genius of it is that she made what it was really not a religious conflict per se, into a religious conflict. She swept the French army up into the sort of frenzy of a crusade that they had righteousness on their side and God had willed that they would be victorious when they were actually completely exhausted from decades and decades of, it's not a stalemate, but it's a sort of back and forth, exhausting, probably for many of them, felt quite pointless. And then you have this young woman riding in on with plate armor, with a special sword, with a banner. I mean, and then all of a sudden you're in a kind of Arthurian legend. And I wonder if that, in these sort of pivotal moments at Orléans in particular, if actually as much as we sort of now look with horror upon kind of religious war and zealotry, if actually that was kind of paradoxically Joan of Arc's brilliance was making it a kind of zealot religious war.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something in that, Sean. I mean, what happens when Joan appears is that that question of the divine right of kings becomes essential, because if her voices are sent by God and that she is inspired by God and she's there because of God, then the Armagnac side is on the right side. So from the moment that Joan appears, of course, the English are already trying to discredit her. They're hurling insults over the walls at her when they see her. They're calling her a whore. They're calling her a witch. They're calling her a harlot. They're throwing all sorts of names at her. And, you know, some of them start to stick as Joan's story unfolds.
It would have been amazing television.
On Radio National, this is God Forbid. We are looking at Joan of Arc. We're with three people who follow her closely to this day: Charlotte Miller, Stephanie Downs, and Sean Blanchard. And in 1429, when she arrives with half a dozen male companions, dressed as a man in armor as well. How many times in history have events changed because of belief? One side, against all the odds, believes they can do something that everyone else thinks they can't. Whether or not that belief is based on so-called truth, whether or not God spoke to you, whether or not you have a realistic expectation of victory, the fact that you simply do, even though it may be irrational, can deliver the victory and history gets changed.
Yeah, that's one of the real takeaways of Joan of Arc. I mean, history is full of absolutely extraordinary people who do kind of heroic or sacrificial things. But one reason that Joan is so exceptional and is remembered so much by so many people is that it does feel that there's a kind of a change here, a sort of turn. And we don't know, of course, what would have happened had she never existed or never rode to Orléans or to Reims. But there is an alternative history here where the English side wins and there's a composite crown. You have a kind of Anglo-French nation state. And, you know, what would that have meant? What would that have meant then for the Protestant Reformation or for the First World War or the Second World War? I mean, we just don't know. So I think that it feels, Joan is one of the few people in history where it really feels like something really profound is turning on the decision she made. There was a moment where the wind changes. And it was pivotal for the French defense of Orléans. That had to do with, I think, reinforcements and getting ships up the river and things like that. But the wind changed, and that was attributed to Joan. So there were rational, to go back to what Charlotte and Stephanie were saying, within their worldview, this is rational stuff. She's claiming to be used by the divine, and she's delivering. So they have every reason to kind of keep riding this momentum.
As a theologian, Sean, and I'll ask Charlotte and Stephanie too, how do you think about this? Is it the hand of God or the accident of fate?
Yeah, I guess what I would see from a theological perspective, I would interpret Joan, interpreting faith as a kind of a complete commitment of yourself to God. So in that sense, I think Joan is a paragon of faith because she's her intellect and her will and everything that she is radically committed to doing what she believes is right and to following the path that God has for her. So I wouldn't say that God is particularly interested in which branch of the House of Valois wins, and that, of course, innocent people were suffering on both sides. So I don't want to give sort of divine sanction to the warfare per se. But I do think that it's an extraordinary story of a young woman who is drawing upon really this, what is now a 2,000-year tradition. I mean, she's looking back at St. Margaret and, you know, at these women who endured horrible torment and were still faithful to God amidst everything in their life. So she really, to me, I see her as kind of a link in a chain of extraordinary people who dedicated themselves completely to God.
Well, Charlotte, what do you say to this? I have witches in mind here as well.
Yeah, I work on witchcraft, so I read a lot of things that I personally don't believe happened. I know some people do, I don't. So we have countless accounts of people levitating to the ceilings of cathedrals, for example, people doing miraculous things, and hundreds of people saying that they witnessed those events. What we have to really focus on here is the power of belief and the power of faith. And if people really strongly believe in something and their entire worldview is set up for that belief to make sense, then it's very easy to read events within that providential divine framework.
And tell me again, what's your 21st century view as you look back through that lens?
My 21st century view is that the wind changed and it was fortunate for Joan, and that there were many things that came after that were not fortunate for Joan.
No disrespect, but isn't that a little anticlimactic?
I know it is. I'm sorry. I'm very disappointing whenever I talk about witches and devils and ghosts, where I sort of say, well, they're very fun, but, and it's very boring to be the wet blanket. I'm sorry. But I do also think that sometimes the truth is more interesting than fiction in a way. I mean, we were talking earlier about whether Joan was mad or not, and I think it would be quite disappointing if she was mad. I think it's much more exciting to think that she had such strong faith and the people around her had such strong faith that she managed to inspire in them, that she made them rethink the way they viewed the conflict and the world. I mean, that is remarkable, really.
Stephanie, what do you say here?
Joan's history has been written retrospectively. You know, we sit here in the 21st century and we look back on who she was and how she accomplished what she did, how it was possible. So we write and we think about Joan with hindsight. The fact of the matter is that the English didn't win the war, the French did. And I can't help but wonder if that in itself seems to me to have played an enormous role in shaping how we think about Joan today, in that extraordinary shift from being condemned as a heretic by the Catholic Church to being canonized by the same church as a saint in 1920. I mean, it's extraordinary, right? This is the only saint that has been both condemned for heresy and then later canonized as a saint, at least in my albeit limited knowledge. There's the trial of Joan's condemnation in 1431, in the year that she is burned at the stake. And then in 1455, and this is just 2 years after the French have kind of officially won the Hundred Years' War, Charles VII agitates for a re-examination of Joan. And that's no accident. Now that the French have won, Joan can literally be rehabilitated as having been sent by God. But in this alternate reality where the English won, that wouldn't have happened. It couldn't have happened. And I don't think that we would have seen Joan canonized as a saint in the earlier 20th century, if it did.
We are looking at Joan of Arc, the sacred soldier. Sean Blanchard, why was she given permission to lead the French forces, a woman leading an army?
Well, I think she was, I mean, I'd be interested to hear what the others think about this, but I mean, she's sort of used, I think, very willingly, and she's a profound, I think, orator and charismatic personality, but she's used as a kind of symbol of the cause. So she's in the inner council of these military leaders. But I think the idea that she's actually making the military decisions as such is at least disputed. And she's, if anything, sort of constantly pushing for immediate and direct action and attack, basically. And that works initially. And she, you know, rolls up tons and tons of victories in this short span of time. But eventually it stops working for kind of military and political reasons. But yes, I mean, she's next to the king when he's crowned in the cathedral in Reims. I mean, so she's absolutely in the inner circle, but I think primarily as a kind of oracle and a kind of symbol of God's blessing of the cause.
Yes, but I think it's even more than that. I mean, one thing we haven't talked about is her actual body itself as being pure. She calls herself La Pucelle, the maid. And so there is this really important link between her ability to hear visions from Christ and also the purity of her body.
She was a virgin, which was significant, wasn't it?
Exactly, that she was a virgin, which is not unusual for a 13-year-old girl, but it's something that she really talked about, the purity and the holiness of her body as a sort of holy vessel for God. And so we have descriptions of her as being sort of virile, which is obviously a more masculine description, but also really quite detailed descriptions of her body being sort of prepubescent as well. And so that body is also a symbol of divinity and holiness and purity. It gives the message that France not only has divine right on their side, but that their cause is a pure one, and she sort of embodies that purity as well.
I think it's really important that Charlotte has raised this moniker that Joan insisted she be known by, La Pucelle. She called herself La Pucelle. It's not till much later, much, much later, after her death, that we ever hear of a Jeanne d'Arc or a Joan of Arc. That was her father's name. At the time, there were a series of prophecies, local prophecies, about a maid who might save France. One popular prophecy was that France would be lost by a woman, but saved by a maiden. The woman in that particular prophecy was understood to be Isabeau of Bavaria. This is Charles VII's mother. She's often acting as regent during these periods in which Charles VI was incapacitated, and she'd actually declared her son, Charles VII, a bastard. She had played a significant role in kind of stoking the civil war in France at that time. There was another prophecy that spoke of a maid of Lorraine. That's kind of fudging the facts a little bit, because Joan wasn't from Lorraine. She was from the other side of that border, but it was kind of close enough. So Joan then kind of fits into these prophecies, and when she arrives on the scene, she seems to be the fulfillment of those prophecies. We talked before about changing wind outside Orléans that Joan predicted. The forces are there. They're planning to arrive in the city, and then the wind is coming from the wrong direction. And Joan says, just wait, just hold, it's going to change. And so she's seen as predicting the change of the wind. And that is seen to be kind of one of the miracles that she performs. All of these things are taken as a sign that she was sent by God. The fact that she can ride a horse when, you know, peasant girls weren't trained to fight in armies and ride horses, all of these things are taken as evidence that Joan has been sent by God. Another way of looking at it is simply that all of these signs that were associated with Joan were attractive because the French were quite simply desperate. They were losing the war in a really bad way, and they needed help. Joan seemed to them to offer that help. And of course, if she really was sent by God, then they couldn't ignore her. And that was one reason that Charles took her claims very seriously, that he had her sent to Poitiers and examined there. She was physically examined to prove her virginity, and her mind was examined by a council of theologians. The transcripts from that particular examination haven't survived. They were lost. But Joan placed a lot of emphasis on them. And when she was later questioned in 1431 in the heresy trial, she kept referring to the Book of Poitiers. And she'd say to her inquisitors, I already answered that question. It's in the book in Poitiers.
And Sean, tell me how she came to be tried. Prior to that, there was betrayal, yes?
Basically, Charles VII because he'd lifted the siege of Orléans, he'd been crowned king, and I think he knew that there was a point militarily that he couldn't push beyond. They attempt to take Paris and fail. Joan is hit by an arrow, but survives. And Joan really wants to keep up this, really, which is kind of a holy war for her. And eventually, in the siege of Compiègne, she's captured by the Burgundians. The army's retreating. The Burgundians ransom her, which is, you know, normally something that you do with the oldest son of an important nobleman or a prince or something like that. But they ransom her to the English for an exorbitant sum, 100,000 francs or something like that. And then the English and pro-English French authorities open a heresy trial, and that you know, again, we were speaking about how difficult it is to sort of separate religion and politics here, but there's a quite naked political goal here, which is to delegitimize Charles VII's claim to the French crown. Because if they can prove that this woman, this young girl who had kind of emerged out of the countryside claiming a divine mandate and standing, you know, literally standing beside him as he's crowned king with her banner and her armor, if they can delegitimize her as a heretic or as a witch or as someone who's in league with the devil in some way, they can thus delegitimize the new king of France.
That's why the English were prepared to pay so much money in ransom to take this otherwise young female maid.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you think the English wanted to prove she was a witch because that would prove that God didn't want the French to hold the crown? Or do you think they wanted to prove she was a witch because it would make their lives politically better?
Well, I think that they, I mean, both, in the sense that I think they're embarrassed, first of all, at the victories that she had won against them. I think they have a sort of grudge against her. But I think the reason that they're proceeding in such a deliberate way and they put such an enormous amount of effort into a kind of a quote-unquote legitimate denunciation of her, conviction of her, is because of the political connotations. Because if they can prove that there's something diabolical rather than angelic about her, then that is a direct strike against the new authority consolidated by Charles VII. So, I mean, I do think, of course, there's lots of things going on here. There's the ramped up inquisitorial general mindset in 15th century Europe, where we have these different heretical groups popping up. So there's a real tension there. It's also misogyny. It's also a grudge because of lost battles. But I think it's primarily an attempt to delegitimize Charles VII.
And Charlotte, how do you see the intersection of royalty, misogyny, politics, and religion?
Oh, that's a big question. I mean, I think that to pick up on what Sean was saying, this is a really key time. So we're in the 1430s, so we're at the very late medieval period, sort of going into the early modern period. And most people, when they think about witchcraft, we've been saying Joan of Arc was tried as a witch, they think of that as a medieval crime, but it's actually an early modern crime. When I say early modern, I mean the 16th, 17th centuries. So we're right on the turning point between thinking about heresy and thinking about witchcraft. So at the same time Joan is being tried, people are very concerned about a new form of diabolical heresy that they believe is coming out and is basically something that affects women. So women are believed far more likely to be in league with the devil than men for two reasons. Neither are good. One is that women are more credulous and so more easily tricked by the devil. And the other is that they are fundamentally evil, as we've seen from Eve in the Garden of Eden tempting man. And so women are already more likely to be seen as people who give in to the devil's influence. And so this link between the supernatural and misogyny is very, very strong here. Joan is being tried for heresy rather than witchcraft, but there's a lot of very similar themes here as well.
Stephanie, what did this mean in practice? A trial, a conviction, an execution, yes?
Exactly so. So Joan's trial, you know, it sounds fairly simple when you sum it up in one word, but in fact it was not. It was a long, drawn out process. She begins her period of incarceration with the Burgundians before she's handed over to the English. And in those circumstances, she seems to have been treated rather more like you'd expect a prisoner of war to be treated. Joan is not, as Sean mentioned, a typical prisoner of war. For starters, she's a woman. And secondly, she's a peasant. She's not a noble. So, you know, she's again, finding herself in a situation in which a person like Joan wouldn't normally be. And the people around her are also a bit perplexed about sort of what to do with her. But so she does start more or less as a prisoner of war in these homes. She's attended by women, English women, and by some local French Burgundian women. And the women are quite perplexed by her too, the women in these households. They don't quite know what to do with her. But there is a story, the later transcripts in particular speak to the fact that these women eventually, Joan kind of took them into her confidence. They were shocked by her at first, but they came to be quite sympathetic to her and pitied by her. And this is a thread that runs all throughout Joan's life, that those people who came into contact with her, that were in the closest contact with her, adored her, revered her. There was simply something about her. They were loyal to her to the end. Some of the men-at-arms who were her closest companions on the battlefield, they were the same. The Duke of Alençon in particular is one of them, whose name often comes up, and who was one of her greatest kind of champions in the later rehabilitation trial. But so eventually she's taken to a prison. She's tried in Rouen. There's a trial that's headed by the Bishop of Beauvais. This is a Burgundian, an English sympathiser. And it's very clear what his agenda is. It's very clear what he has to do. His name is Pierre Cochon, which sounds a little bit like the French cochon. And there have been meaning pig. And there are lots of puns about his role in this trial, you know, where the conclusion is already set. And he just has to try and trick Joan into saying what she shouldn't say. Although there's even evidence that he himself felt a certain amount of pity towards her. Joan, for example, was shown the instruments of torture, but she was never physically tortured by them. She was, however, still under extreme duress. She was in a cell. She was chained. We don't know exactly what those conditions were, but they were pretty awful. The trial transcripts that survive are quite simply extraordinary. They go on for a long time because Joan was no fool, and she didn't give them the answers they wanted. She avoided questions. She skirted around them. And or she just gave answers that were consistent with what the church wanted to hear. So this did go on for quite some time, and it has left us with an enormous amount of archival material relating to Joan. We have more information about Joan from these trials than we do really about any other woman in particular from the Middle Ages, maybe any person from the 15th century, full stop. But the point at which they do get Joan in the end is something that we hadn't talked about, and it's something that's really important. Joan isn't burned at the stake for witchcraft. She's burned at the stake as a relapsed heretic. And the point that it really turns on is her wearing of male attire, her wearing of masculine dress, and the fact that she has her hair cut short like a boy. The reason that this is so important at this point is because of Joan's claim that God has insisted that she dress in this way. Joan says this repeatedly, that God and her voices have commanded that she wear masculine clothing, that it is necessary for her to do so. And this, in the eyes of the church, condemns her because of the fact that she's claiming this close relationship with God. She's bypassing the church militant on earth. She's going straight to the church triumphant in heaven. And she's saying that this was the command that she received. The other reason that it's sort of dangerous, Charlotte talked before about Joan's body and the importance of Joan's body, and the clothes also serve at this point in Joan's story to condemn her because of the fact that they emphasise her body, that they turn Joan herself into a kind of idol that is worshipped by the people. When Joan rode through the villages, we know that people treated her as if she were a saint already. They reached out to touch her, to pull her clothing, to take, you know, sort of pieces of her with them. They wanted her blessing. And that was, I think, a very dangerous thing in the eyes of the church. So she's ultimately burned at the stake for this kind of fundamental transgression.
And Charlotte, she, according to legend, what, asks to see the cross as she dies, as she burns?
Yes, she asks to have a cross held in front of her, and she focuses on the cross. And then one thing that's important about her being burnt, I should say also that when you're found guilty of heresy, that's not actually the crime they get you for, because then you repent and it's okay. It's because what Joan did is she confessed to heresy and she said she wouldn't put on the male clothing, and then she did it again. And so, as Stephanie said, that then made her a relapsed heretic, which meant the church then handed her over to secular authorities to burn her. So it's a small distinction that the church doesn't burn people, they just hand them over to people to burn. But as she's burning, she's watching the cross, and they burn her down to the ashes. And this is important because her ashes are then scattered, which means she can't have a burial. She can't have a proper burial in consecrated ground. But also, perhaps even more importantly, she can't have a relic made out of her. So a relic is a piece of a saint that people keep and venerate. And people knew, as Stephanie said, the church knew that people would want a piece of Joan because they really did venerate her as a saint. So her body being burnt is both punishment but also a very practical strategy to try and end the legend of Joan.
So, Sean Blanchard, how can the church, the Catholic Church, have been so down on her to insist she be burnt to ashes, even though they didn't get their hands dirty in doing it, only for her 100 years ago in the 1920s to be made a saint herself?
Well, I mean, when we say the church did X or did Y, I mean, these are pro-English, you know, pro-Burgundian courts. So the church is this massive institution spanning Europe and in some cases beyond. And they can disagree amongst themselves sort of just as much as kind of political authorities. And again, the distinction there, of course, we've talked about is always quite messy. So only 25 years later, she's actually rehabilitated by a different church court with different political leanings who happened to support Charles VII and the kind of French claim back on the throne. And Joan's mother is still alive. Joan's mother actually gives evidence in favor of her daughter. So there were always sort of split opinions within the church about, is this a sort of special saint from God, a kind of prophetic figure, or is this a subversive, diabolical figure? So that tension was certainly present in her life and just after her death. But there's a slow growth of devotion. I mean, there's devotion immediately after her death in Orléans and in Rouen, where she's burned. So there's sort of a local cult. It becomes a national cult. The French Revolution, you know, begins in a sort of not necessarily anti-Christian or anti-religion, but in its radical phase, it's sort of trying to suppress expressions of the Catholic faith and sort of destroy the institution. They don't really know what to do with the cult of Joan of Arc, but Napoleon very wisely, very shrewdly kind of reestablishes it. And it becomes, for post-1789 France, for post-revolutionary France, a society that's completely riven in all sorts of ways, you know, religiously and politically, but she becomes a symbol that pretty much everyone in France can agree is a sort of positive expression of French identity. So in a way that, you know, they couldn't, of course, agree about someone like Voltaire or Louis IX, but they can agree about Joan. And then eventually the Bishop of Orléans, who was a very well-known intellectual in 1869, his name was Félix Dupanloup, he formally petitions the Vatican to begin this process. And at that point, the kind of administrative wheels are turning. And eventually she is canonized a saint in 1920. So the thing that surprises me is not that it took formal petition in 1869 until 1920. That's just the way that it used to take decades. But rather that the formal petition was rendered only in 1869. I'm surprised that this process wasn't begun in the 15, 16, 1700s, something like that.
And Charlotte, what about this legacy that Sean touches on of Joan of Arc? She offers something for everyone. In France, we see to this day, like far-right French politicians, Marie Le Pen, for example, co-opting, appropriating Joan of Arc as a symbol of French purity. The Vichy Nazi collaborators did the same thing. At the same time, the French colonies, like Algeria and Vietnam, in their resistance to French rule, would also take Joan of Arc as a, you know, resistor to foreign imperialism.
I mean, it's really remarkable. And I think it's a strength of her conviction of the how many people can make what they will from her. One thing I was thinking about when I was asked to come on this program is the idea of her as a religious rebel. And I wondered, is that because she is a rebel against her religion or for her religion? And you can actually read it either way, because you could say that she's someone who really rose up for what she believed in, but then it went against the church. So I think there's that sort of contradiction inherent in Joan of Arc, that we see her as a deeply religious figure, but then she's burnt for heresy. And so because of that inherent contradiction that's there from the very start, it's quite easy for really very opposing groups to make of her what they will.
And Stephanie, one person's rebellion is another person's orthodoxy. Is that why she is so many things to so many people, Joan of Arc, to this day?
Yeah, I mean, exactly so, James. I'm a literary studies scholar. That's how I approach Joan. So Joan's legacy is something that I'm really fascinated by. Joan's life, at the end of the day, is a text. It's a text that is available to multiple interpretations. And indeed, many different groups have brought their interpretations to Joan, all of which bring out different themes in her story: nationalism, feminism, faith, gender, all of these sorts of ways of understanding Joan, what she achieved, her death, are available in Joan's story, which can't really be pinned down, I don't think, to a single truth.
So, last question to all, who would she be fighting today if she were alive?
That's a fascinating question.
I think whoever she'd be fighting, she would really, really believe in it. I don't know what it would be, but I do believe that Joan couldn't have done what she did without having such strong conviction that she was doing something that only she could do and that she had the right to do. So I'm not sure what it would be, but I think she would fight it all the way to the end.
You agree, Stephanie?
Look, I mean, I don't know if this is a good place for me to jump in and mention Baz Luhrmann's proposed film, James. One of the things about this film that is reportedly in casting at the moment is that it's based on a novel by none other than Thomas Keneally. Thomas Keneally wrote Blood Red, Sister Rose in 1974. This is, of course, the same Keneally that wrote the book Schindler's Ark that became a famous Spielberg film.
Schindler's List.
Schindler's List. That's exactly right. And Keneally and Luhrmann, it's an interesting pairing. They have rather a lot in common. Not only were they both raised Catholic, but they actually even went to the same Catholic school. So some of the same images of Catholicism would have been present to both men in their formative years. Keneally went to the seminary in Manly to train for the priesthood. He had a crisis of faith. He left to pursue his writing. But Joan seems to have been a figure that he was fascinated with. His first novel incorporates an allusion to Joan as a priest who has a vision of Joan. Later, a novel he wrote, a very strange novel, actually, set in rural New South Wales called A Dutiful Daughter. One of the main characters in that novel is contemporary fiction, but this woman is obsessed with Joan's story. And she actually finds that she has in her possession, by a sort of accident of fate, a copy of the missing transcript of Joan's examination in Poitiers. And then finally, in Blood Red, Sister Rose, his novel about Joan, this is really the novel that sort of catapulted him to international fame. He treats the story of Joan's life in full. So quite recently, Keneally is on record as having saying that he's spoken with Luhrmann about the film and that he endorses Luhrmann's vision. He says that he and Luhrmann have the same vision of Joan, a vision of Joan as a revolutionary figure with profound relevance today. So Keneally has an answer to that question that you've asked about who Joan might be today. He nominates Greta Thunberg as a modern-day Joan.
Well, Sean, we turn to a man for the last answer, and it seems with seems with Baz Luhrmann and Thomas Keneally, there'll always be men telling us who Joan was.
Yeah, thanks for that, James. If she were alive today, I think she would be within the Catholic Church, but causing a lot of trouble. I think she would be a deeply pious. She would be a deeply pious Catholic woman who gets into lots of arguments with clergy and is pushing for a greater voice for women in the church.
And she'd be in good company, as I have been for this hour. Thank you so much to Charlotte, Stephanie, and Sean for being on the panel, a special series on God Forbid on Religious Rebels this week, looking at Joan of Arc. Sean Blanchard, thank you so much.
Thank you, James, and thank you, Stephanie and Charlotte.
Sean is a lecturer in theology at the University of Notre Dame, Australia, the Fremantle campus. His anticipated fifth book, Catholicism and the Enlightenment. Stephanie Downes from the Department of Language and Cultures at La Trobe University. Thank you, Stephanie.
Thank you.
Stephanie's co-author of a chapter in a book titled The Gendered Reputations in Aristocratic Partnership, including a section on the trial of Joan of Arc. And Charlotte Miller. Thanks, Charlotte.
Thanks so much.
Charlotte from the University of Melbourne, a cultural historian specialising very much in the witch hunts of early modern Europe. You can email me at godforbid@abc.net.au. Big thanks to producer Beck Kushwe and Amanda Roberts. I'm James Carlton. This has been God Forbid, part of our series on religious rebels. Until next week's edition, remember to be good, or at least defiantly faithful. This has been God Forbid.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.